This fine episode from the Packet Pushers Network is brought to you in part by Cumulus Networks web-scale networking for the digital age. Visit cumulusnetworks.com/ppautomation to download a free automation white paper.
This episode is sponsored in part by ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes gives you visibility, insights, and actionable intelligence into user experience from every user to every application over any network. So you transform your WAN, troubleshoot faster, and deliver exceptional user experiences in the cloud and on-premises. Try ThousandEyes for free at ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers and snag a fun t-shirt. ThousandEyes. Thrive in a connected world.
One of the networking trends we've been keenly interested in here at Packet Pushers International Headquarters is open networking. Open networking implies many things, but at the core of it, open networking is about the ability to create your own networking stack. You choose the hardware and software, pair it up with a controller, roll in some monitoring, tweak to suit your organization's unique requirements, and you've got something special. Of course, open networking also shifts technical responsibility back to the network consumer or maybe the consultants that you guys have brought in. And so maybe it's not for all of you, or is it? To talk to us in this installment of our Future of Networking series is Arpit Joshipura, General Manager for Networking and Orchestration at the Linux Foundation. Arpit, welcome to the Packet Pushers Weekly Show. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Well, okay, let's jump in about open networking. Can you, Arpit, define open networking from the Linux Foundation perspective, because there's a lot of aspects to it. This isn't simply frame and packet forwarding.
Absolutely right. There are two terms that are being used in the industry today. One is open networking, and the other one is open source networking. Now, I had the luxury of coining those way back when, but I would sort of put them in context of, one, which is open networking, pretty much implies disaggregation, meaning, buy hardware separately from software or buy separate softwares and mix and match and, as you said, pull up what you want. Open source networking is really a broader term that includes disaggregation, but also develops code in an open source manner that can be put as Lego blocks and put into a bigger stack. So if you look at the two terms, open networking, open source networking, there are slightly different meanings. And from a Linux Foundation perspective, we view as open source networking as kind of the umbrella of how future network stacks are going to be built.
There's also, I think a usage that I've heard, particularly among, I guess I don't want to say legacy vendors because that sounds pejorative, but they use the term open often to say that, we've got APIs, our systems can talk with other systems, with third-party systems, and they call that open. Does that fall into your umbrella as well? Do you think that's a separate animal?
It's a minor subset of open networking in my mind, because anyone, any vendor, any ASIC vendor, any hardware vendor, or even a software vendor can absolutely open their APIs, any REST APIs or any APIs, and say, sure, go ahead, program my chip, program my box, program my software, and I'm open. There's also a tendency to throw a portion of the code on GitHub and call it open source, right? And here's the reality. There are thousands and thousands of projects on GitHub. Not everything is relevant, right? Uh-huh. Projects that need and build a community, that create shared IP across multiple end users, multiple vendors, are the ones Linux Foundation focuses on. And kind of that's the open source networking that I'm talking about. Mm.
So from that perspective then, Arpit, is the future of networking open or open source?
It's both. It's open from... and it's a perspective of, if you're a vendor who is just building white boxes and trying to penetrate this market that is predominantly dominated by a few vendors, for you, it's really open networking, right? You're supplying hardware, you put any stack on it, and you're done. From a perspective of a software vendor, it's the other way around. But from a perspective of a system vendor and an end user, it's really open source networking.
So I just want to extend this a bit further, because I think there's another category of participant in open source that we haven't always thought of, and that is customers who develop their own software for their own use, and then they open source it to see if they can get more people to come around it. And there's we're seeing companies like Uber and Dropbox and Docker And, you know, so many of these different users who have no, they're not vendors, they're not there to sell software. But by putting software into the open source, they can build a community around that, which they can then consume. But more importantly, they can recruit from that community. A lot of companies are open sourcing just to recruit from communities that they build.
Yes, and that has been what I call the first wave of open source projects, right? And we've seen several of these projects from Uber, Google, et cetera. The challenge there is it is still the community of their supply chain, right? So, you know, whoever supplies to Google or Uber is forced to participate in that project. And it is not really a community development. What we're seeing now, and you know, companies like AT&T are experts at that, is they open source a project and then they put it in a foundation like the Linux Foundation, where we work proactively across global carriers and global end users and vendors and grow the community. And then they can recruit from it, right? So the pull of a foundation-led project versus just putting it on their own is possibly 10x in terms of just developers.
I just wanted to flag that because we talk so much about vendors. Mm-hmm. But what we're also seeing is this emergence in the as major participants, not just participants, but also initiator of open source project, which is customers, usually very large customers, of course, but because they're the ones who've got the mojo and the money to allocate developers to producing this stuff. And that's a new form of open project that we haven't seen before.
So
in networking in particular, Cumulus, of course, have been open sourcing substantial amounts of code.
Correct.
Bara, for example.
Yes, and I think that is absolutely a category. I would say that is inclusive in the open source networking bucket as an end user driven innovation that pulls a community together. And I think we did not go into this, but it's worth highlighting on why someone would open source, right? Specifically an end user. And it's all about what I call control, consistency, and cost, right? And you should note, I did not say cost as number one. Really, it's all about control, where you control your software, you control your releases, you control your patches, you have the ability to modify, and you're not at the mercy of a vendor. That's kind of the first benefit of open source. Then you have consistency, right? Interoperability is by default an inherent trait of open source networking. You don't have to spend 6 months doing POCs to see if, you know, flag and bit number 7 has been coded to a 1 between 5 vendors, right? Because not all flags are defined, as we all know. And then the cost is mostly not an OPEX, a CAPEX thing. It's really an OPEX where you have now consistency of managing and operating these entities. And that's kind of the drivers of open source. And that's why we're seeing, as you said, a lot of end users starting to push this model across the industry.
But it's end users that tend to be larger organizations now where they can do software development in-house and they've got the staff to maintain whatever the custom open networking is that they've built for themselves. They have those business drivers, they have the staff, they have the money, they can push ahead in that way. So the question, Arpit, then is open, and this model that we're talking about, is that open for some people, those kinds of customers that I just described, or is it eventually, is the future here going to be everyone's going to adopt this model?
What we have seen globally is your assessment is correct, right? Which is you start off with the large players who tend to have enough pull as well as people to put at the problem. We have started seeing that phenomena is now moving to the mid-sized players as well, because the way they do it is not just apply people and resources, but they sign up for, you know, projects like ONAP, if you may, and then that forces the vendors to support them, their vendors in their supply chain to support them and do the development in open. Now, the value to the vendors is significant because all of a sudden, you know, they're cutting down time to revenue, they're cutting down time to deployment, et cetera. And so the mid-tiers are definitely starting to see, they will not be the early adopters, but they will definitely benefit from this whole open phenomenon.
We hear over and over again that there's a complaint about networking, that everybody builds their own kind of network, they're all their own special snowflakes. which can lead to complexity. Is open networking trying to drive toward a more simplified network design, or by contrast, given the number and explosion around open source projects, are we going to get even more special snowflakes out there?
I would say the snowflakes and Lego analogy has been used quite a bit here, right? and everybody would claim that they're not building their own snowflakes, or their snowflake is better than the Blizzard that came out from the other guy, and I think at the end of the day, you have to step back and look at the use cases and look at the problem the end users are trying to solve. And that problem is very simple, right? You have multiple technology disruptions that just happened in the last 3 to 5 years. And, we all know about it. SDN, virtualization, NFV, VNFs, right? And you take all these building blocks and then you integrate them into a solution, right, that results in some value to their users. So effectively what we have done is we have all these projects in open source that all interoperate and work together that create a solution for the end user. And then that solution gets deployed and delivered by the vendors and by the system integrators. So the biggest thing that we have changed in the last 1 year is Linux Foundation has been the champion of driving what I call harmonization. And harmonization includes collaboration between open source and open standards, collaboration between open source and open source, right? So projects and getting to making sure that there is no repetition of these projects. And so once the industry realizes that there are, snowflakes that now look like Lego blocks, stacks become easy to develop. And I think that is where we are seeing a lot of push by end users as well as vendors. And most of that is happening at the orchestration layer, at the automation layer, at the control layer, right? And we're moving down into the data plane once again, once the whole programmability of the data plane has started evolving.
So if I could say that back to you then, it sounds like I can still have specialization or customization, but if I'm working with open source software, there should be some integration or interoperability regardless of what pieces I'm plucking and putting together.
Exactly. Do the customization on the top because that's what differentiates you. Standardize at the bottom.
Okay.
A minute ago, you said disruption and disruptive, Arpit. One of my favorite words to pick on because everybody's talking about their disruptive technology and mostly it isn't. And even SDN and that kind of stuff, it's been disruptive-ish. It certainly hasn't been transformative in that the vast majority of networking out there is pretty much looks like what it looked like 10 years ago. But you have these pockets of disruption, I guess, or innovation. Again, going back to those web scale players that have massive amounts of buying power and then the wherewithal to develop their custom networking solutions. Okay, so let's take a step back here. If we look at open networking, do we really mean that this is a disruptive thing? And in that sense, I would mean that disruption would change the way most people are buying their networks today. If that disruption is actually happening and actually going to be true for everyone in the industry, what does networking market share look like in 5 years or maybe 10 years? We kind of know what it looks like today with a lot of certain big names and what their pieces of the pie chart look like. What's it look like later?
Okay. So in my mind, the way I have always defined disruption, I've been leading some of these projects over the last 30 years, is anytime a technology or a piece of technology allows new players to enter and get some share, that's disruption, right? It's essentially creating something that the incumbent could not create. And so if you look back at history, virtualization allowed sort of the VMwares to enter the server market, right? SDN allowed the non-Cisco Juniper, et cetera, to enter the market, right? Disaggregation allowed white box vendors like, the Quantas and et cetera to enter the market. So each of these pieces, if you may, have created the ability for a non-incumbent to enter, right? Which really is redefining the networking space and the innovation and the rate of innovation. Having said that, we segment the market very simply, right? And we show that at all of our open networking summits. But if you look at the three big buckets, there is the cloud market, then there's the carriers market or service providers, and then there's the enterprise, right? And to your point, how does the market look like in 5 to 10 years? Well, let's do one click down on each of these markets. We all know that the cloud is already open sourced. It's already, you know, disaggregated. It's already automated, right? The Googles and the Amazons and the Microsofts and the Azures, you know, they are already marching down that route. Now, keep in mind, their workload or their service or their application is a single purpose, right? So like Google does a search engine or Amazon does e-commerce, right? When you look at the complexities of workloads and services for enterprises, they get quite complex, right? So keep that in mind. But in my mind, they got the cloud market is already, you know, majority disaggregated, disaggregated and automated, right? The next wave is hitting the telecom or the service provider or the carriers as we know it right now. Projects like ONAP, Open Daylight, OPNFE, right? Like there's a ton of open source projects that are aimed right at that market. And the guys like AT&T, China Mobile, Vodafone, Orange, Verizon, right? They are all heading down this path of automating their network using open source building blocks. So we're starting to see, announcements from the largest of the large carriers of, you know, things like deploying 60,000 white boxes, deploying, you know, 60% of their network goes automated and SDN, right? So that whole journey, we're expecting to be, to hit a critical mass in the next 2 to 5 years. So by 2022, as we have seen the forecasts, as well as we have seen the architectural shifts, it's all open source networking, open networking, disaggregated networking, virtualized networking, et cetera, right? And we're not analyst firms, so we don't actually size the market, but there are plenty of analyst firms who would probably put that market around $15 billion, right, in 2022. And then if you look at, say, enterprise networking, that's lagging. And it is lagging because of lack of networking resources that can be applied to this. But it is also lagging because, let's be honest, they got burned by open source several years ago when they tried OpenStack, right? And it took a lot of work to put it all together. The good news now is, you know, Kubernetes is really helping them to simplify, and the entire container movement is getting there. And so we're starting to see signs of the enterprise networking moving to open source pickup, especially around the fintechs and the automotives and some of the manufacturing. So that's kind of a high-level view of the market.
I mean, I'm hearing you say on the enterprise side, we know the story of the web scale and the telecoms. We've been hearing that one a lot because they're huge wins. And they're such big buyers that, yeah, it makes news because it's definitely impactful to the traditional networking vendor's bottom line. But the enterprise is a really interesting story in that, boy, it doesn't seem to be taking hold. I don't know that OpenStack is the only, barrier there. I mean, you cited them as kind of an example. Hey, we tried OpenStack and it was hard. You know, it didn't integrate well. And maybe some folks have their OpenStack and they're just using it quietly, but that hasn't moved on so much. But open networking, I mean, we talk about especially disaggregation and white box and so on, it feels like there's a play for the enterprise there for a lot of different reasons, but yet the uptake is still, well, slow. So maybe the question is, with the service providers and so on leading the way, hammering out these solutions, figuring out how to get it done, does that make the consumption problem go away where it's easier for enterprises to pick up this stuff because some of these other larger shops have gone through the pain and kind of figured it out, and the end result of these open source projects is they're more consumable?
Yes, absolutely. You hit it right there. So what we're seeing is the carriers are deploying open source networking, not just in their network, but also in their data centers, meaning on their IT side. So, you know, Bell Canada, for example, could be selling, you know, flowers, if you may, right? I mean, yeah, they're selling network services, but they put the open source stack of ONAP on automating their data center inside the IT systems, right, on the intranet. We have had use cases where Microsoft 360 was run on a ONAP platform. We've seen ONAP as inter-data center, closed-loop control, optical link modification. So what has happening is the carriers and the telcos are leading the way to show IT use cases, okay? So in other words, enterprise use cases that allow the that set a tone for the larger enterprise to start looking at it and start adopting. So you're absolutely right. There is a huge potential and a huge opportunity. I think the number one barrier is the fact that, you know, they may have one or two people in the networking staff, in the IT staff under the CIO organization. And they're just consumed maintaining the network and making sure that the routers and switches don't go down.
We are pausing today's episode for a couple of minutes to explain a new idea from our sponsor, Cumulus Networks. That new idea is packaged around an acronym, S-O-U-L, or SOUL. What's SOUL stand for in Cumulus speak? Simple, open, untethered Linux. Simple. It should be easy to try things, configure, run and monitor, and then scale when you need to grow your network. No reason for these things to be hard. Open. Openness gives you choice and flexibility, meaning you can adjust the networking stack to be whatever your business needs it to be, which in turn frees them up to offer whatever products and services they dream up. Untethered. This is the idea of disaggregation, where you don't have to buy a network operating system packaged with a network switch. You can make whatever combinations you like, facilitating automation tooling and affordable scaling. Linux. If you use Linux for your NAS, you can manage your network like you manage everything else in the data center. Network operations doesn't have to be an isolated silo. So, do you care about Cumulus's SOUL idea then? You should give it some thought. CIO Magazine predicts that by 2020, there will be 4.1 billion internet users with 26.3 billion networked devices. So depending on how you do that math, that's going to result in a data center traffic increase of as much as 330%. If your network grows to match the demand, simple, open, untethered Linux, that might start to sound compelling. If you don't know Cumulus, they have two main products. Cumulus Linux is an open network operating system that is truly Linux and runs on over 70 different hardware platforms. You can save real money here running Cumulus Linux on a white box switch. The second product is NetQ, offering deep insight into what's going on in your network. NetQ's goal is to make network operations simpler and troubleshooting significantly easier. Now, we've talked about data centers and web-scale networks, but Cumulus can work in any network. So to learn more, check out their white paper explaining 5 automation tips and tricks for your network. I have read the white paper, and if you're new to network automation, you will get some good stuff to think about. Visit cumulusnetworks.com/ppautomation to download the automation white paper. And if you talk to anyone at Cumulus, tell them you heard about them on Packet Pushers. And now, back to the show.
Arpit, you'd mentioned folks maybe being burned by OpenStack, but now Kubernetes is sort of coming into the enterprise, and you sort of spoke of that as a wedge maybe for open source. Can you talk a little bit more about how you think that's going to help bring open source down into the networking stack?
Oh, sure. So as we all know, the biggest value of Kubernetes is really container portability, right? And there's a whole set of work groups that are being spun off as well as integrated within Kubernetes and specifically CNCF communities, where the networking challenges that exist right are simplified and they are deployed. So at the Linux Foundation, what we are doing is, you know, we have two major areas, right? One is LF networking and the other one is CNCF, which hosts Kubernetes. And what we are doing is we're collaborating within the groups and figuring out what the simplest way of pulling the network stacks together without, and this is the key, without repeating the same solutions that got us into trouble in the first place, right? And this is true all the way from V6 to ACLs to Quas to Guest OS. I mean, we won't go into the details of it, but the community on both sides is extremely focused on making sure that as new applications and as new virtual network functions get developed, they are working both in a cloud native environment as well as they can be portable across the clouds, right? So we will be bringing out a lot of new concepts at our open source summit in August, and something called CNFs or cloud native functions, which essentially mean that you are now taking these microservices and making them portable across the network layer, and you're getting connectivity like you would otherwise, right? In a normal network.
Yeah, the collaboration aspect sounds interesting too, Arpit, in that that seems to be one of the big things OpenStack got wrong in its early days. There was a lot of projects doing similar things that were contributed to OpenStack, and there was an attitude of, if I didn't build it myself, I'm not interested. I'm going to build it, even though there were other projects out there that did a very similar thing. Getting the collaboration right really matters to further this effort, especially with operators that are at an enterprise level, because they want something they can count on, not bank on a project and then find out it's abandoned 6 months later.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think the not invented here syndrome is gone. I mean, at the end of the day, we serve our community and our end users and our vendors and our members, and they're not interested in, being right. They're just being interested in getting a solution that works for them. Right. So as I said, we've issued, things like harmonization with standards. We're also, at the Open Networking Summit, there was a big announcement about what I call Harmonization 2.0, which is really taking networking concepts of open source and starting to expand it into cross-project collaboration. So project collaboration with Kubernetes, right? I think I showed a demo of ONAP running on Kubernetes. Collaboration with new edge projects like Acrino, where you orchestrate down all the way to the edge of the network for applications that require 5 to 20 milliseconds of latency. Collaboration with deep learning and Acumos type projects, which is a lot of machine learning algorithms that are and that are rich in the network networking area that needs to be fed in to make very, very sharp policy decisions for closed loop control. So we're seeing a lot of that happen across the community, and at the Linux Foundation, we are just there to enable the collaboration. And I think that's the right way to build things forward.
Al, I mean, that's all that is a very rosy picture you painted. I hope that is actually what goes down over the next few years as these projects go on, because you can't take ego out of the equation. And there's a lot of folks that are really talented that that want to put their stamp on things. And there's inevitably some conflicts that are going to happen.
Absolutely. And I think what happens is when there is, that's one thing I learned about open source, right? The best solution typically wins. And the decisions are made so publicly that nobody gets hurt, right? And if you are familiar with how open source voting is done, how open source recommendation is done, the smart guys just pile on the right ideas and then they approve it, right? And so we always get the best of the ideas, and then people build on it. So I've seen a shift in the last couple of years on how ideas are getting nailed. Now, clearly, if it's done with end users and vendors together, that's the most powerful. If it's done in isolation, then of course, there'll be a competitor that would try and resist. But we've not seen that too much.
All right, I want to talk about money. So some people argue that traditional networking and open networking end up being about the same cost. You save some money on hardware or NAS acquisition, but you got to invest in people on the back end to make it all work. And so it kind of balances out. On the other hand, I have heard some people argue, like Peyton Maynard Curran, that you can save a whole ton of money going open. And I'm curious if you had a take on that.
Yeah, so Peyton and I actually presented a business case at one of the large conferences, right, on saving money. And here's the thing. We've seen several analysts come out with models that basically have savings of up to about 30% on the CapEx side using Open. But the most important saving comes from the OpEx side, right? Where when a router or a switch needs to be upgraded, when a new load needs to be added, when they have to switch vendors, the downtime and the operational alignment that has happened is completely consistent. And it does not take hours and weeks to sort of do that. And that's kind of where the biggest value is from an end user perspective. And then secondly, the buying cycle, if you look at every 3 to 5 years, the buying cycle definitely does not command a premium because there are open alternatives. So that effectively allows them to buy more for the same price and, you know, expand the overall market without paying a lot more. So
there's an emerging aspect here as well where open source skills like Linux are useful everywhere. So your skill set is portable to any employer, which opens up the horizons for your career. Whereas today, you know, the market in most of the non-open markets are dominated by monopolies or companies who have a substantial market share. But getting into open skills in time probably is going to be a better career move because you're going to be more portable if the momentum builds over time. Is that a fair statement?
That is absolutely a fair statement. In fact, I would point out two things. You know, GitHub is your resume if you're a new grad, and open source is your foot stamp, right, on what you have done in terms of projects as well as code. So that is a given. What we have also seen is the tooling on open source and the skill sets that bring with it. So DevOps, GitHub, Jenkins, you know, all the and even language skills that are completely portable. Meaning, you know, you're not stuck with Perl or Python or you know, Go or this. Right? It's the language is not the issue. It's the modeling.
What you're suggesting is, you know, if I know this vendor CLI, if I know how this vendor implements BGP, if I know how this vendor does its OSIS or its queuing algorithm, whatever it is, that's a useful skill so long as that vendor's dominant.
Correct.
And then every other customer's got that. But that's no longer the case.
Correct.
You know, we're seeing market shares transition across the board. I mean, a Microsoft Windows server is no longer the dominant operating system for server platforms. VMware is being challenged by OpenStack and Kubernetes. So vSphere ESX skills are becoming still key, but not necessarily the only game in town. In networking, we've seen Cisco's market share transition in different ways, you know, like, you know, they're not the same dominant that they used to be in the market. So all of a sudden, your Cisco skills are less relevant. Juniper's had the same thing. And I think we could get to a situation where open skills are just more portable and more valuable in your career because there's going to be more customers using them. That's not where we are today. That is an aspirational comment, though.
In fact, I would say we are there today because if you look at the latest job report that came out from, I think we published it as part of the open source skill sets that are needed. Networking has made it to the top five.
And okay.
So,
and I think that's we can put it in the show notes for people.
Sure, absolutely. We'll get you a link. And it is surprising, but it's rapidly developing skill sets that is needed to have open networking skills. And it, you know, obviously Linux is the number one, but, you know, it very, very quickly, networking has jumped up in the top five.
Talking about skills and talking about cost, I feel like in some ways there's kind of a chicken and egg problem with open networking for the enterprise. So the argument could be, well, if we bring in open source, we can get more people on staff because we'll save money on the other end. But those people then need to be trained up. And so that's another cost. And so there's sort of like, is there a wedge or a tipping point where a forward-looking network operations team can go to the business and say, here's a key value proposition, why we need to start experimenting with this, why we need to move forward with this?
Yeah. So what we are seeing is here's how organizations are getting into open source. So the first thing they do is there are plenty of free online courses, right? E-learning courses that both Linux Foundation Training offers, right? On open source networking, on networking, etc. That they take. There's custom courses that can be prepared. But then what they do is they team up with their vendors who are already capable of open source skill sets, and then they jointly work in the community to start pushing these projects into the development organizations. Now, most of the enterprises or carriers, this work gets started in the CTO group and then moves into the BU and then the operations. More advanced end users have done reorgs to pull in CTO operations as well as BUs together in a more cross dotted line kind of a matrix organization. And those are the ones who have a lot more people as well as a lot more emphasis on open source adoption. So there's several of these training tools available to get very quickly on, speed it up to deployment.
Yeah, there's definitely lots of training resources out there, but I guess I'm thinking more along the lines of, you know, if in my organization we're doing things one way and we've always done them that way, how do I go to the business or even, you know, a business unit and say, we can change, we can do things better, but how do I communicate that kind of value proposition? Is there some key message? I guess I feel like there's sort of an organizational operational change that has to happen that can be a little difficult to get going.
Yeah, and I think what I'm saying is in most of the cases we have seen, the CTO team takes a lead.
Okay, so there's some kind of executive push happening from the top.
Exactly. And then they stand up the environment jointly with their vendors, and they show the path to the their internal exec team and then their BU or their product teams to sort of go from here to there, right? So historically, if you look at networking, the CTO team would look at bell curve specs and standards and then say, okay, this is where we are heading, right? They're still doing that for the lower layers of the network on 5G and, you know, OIF and IEEE and all that. But for the higher layers of the network, they're looking at open source and saying, this is where we should be going. So that's the shift. Mm.
Okay, makes sense.
How about a business perspective shift, Arpit? I guess I'm thinking about opportunities. So if you look at open networking as an emerging market, then what business opportunities are out there? What is being presented, both maybe interesting startup ideas, or if you're an established vendor and you're looking at revenues maybe being threatened by the open networking model, what business opportunities are presented by open networking?
So I think we had one of the reports that was done by an analyst firm called ACG, which exactly looked at this problem. And they kind of identified, I would say, 3 to 5 major areas where there are opportunities. So I'll start off with the simplest one, right? The simplest one being customizing and helping the transformation of the network from a proprietary to an open source, right? So I'm Bell Canada, I'm Swisscom, I'm Verizon, you know, name your player. I have decided that I want to go open source, but I don't have resources, I don't have the skills, I don't know how to do it. Hey, vendor XYZ, can you help? And this is their preferred vendor list. And then there's your customization, there's your consulting, there's your partnership, there's your, you know, batch of developers that are contributing on your behalf, et cetera, right? So that's the largest of the business opportunity that we have seen. And it is a fair play. It is a even field. You know, we've seen people like, you know, Cisco, Juniper, Ericsson, Huawei, Nokia support that. But more importantly, the startups like, you know, InnoCybe, Lumina, you know, Aptera, there's like several smaller players that have come in, and obviously, you know, people like Amdocs, they have come in and taken a slice of the dollars from the carriers. The money is there. The carriers don't have a problem investing in new technology and new solutions, right? It's where the pie goes. Do they put it in their proprietary operations and automation systems, or do they put it in open source? And if they put it in open source, which vendor do they go with? So that's kind of the predominant business case that we are starting to see, and the analysts have quantified it. Second is once the deployment and everything happens, now comes the features that are needed to enable new services for their particular domain, right? So the great news about the telecom environment is, you know, there's competition, but that's not a global competition, right? Vodafone doesn't compete with AT&T. China Mobile does not compete with Reliance Jio. So they are more motivated to collaborate, but then there's always the internal local competition. And that's where we've seen a lot of, say, you know, Huawei and ZTE and all the China vendors support China Mobile and develop their features for the China environment. We've seen, you know, Amdocs and Tech Mahindra and sort of those guys develop features for AT&T in the US environment, etc.
Let's pause the podcast for a moment to tell you about today's sponsor, ThousandEyes. Like it or not, your organization is embracing the cloud, and that might be great for the business, but for network architects and IT ops teams, it can be a service delivery nightmare. Why? Well, you're depending on cloud providers, ISPs, and third-party apps for business-critical services. And even though you don't control those networks, you do own the service delivery, which means if performance is bad, people are going to come looking for you. And this is where ThousandEyes can help. You can take advantage of ThousandEyes agents across the cloud within your enterprise all the way down to the endpoint. These agents actively monitor network behavior and topologies and how they affect application performance. With ThousandEyes, you can correlate multiple layers of performance data from L2 to L7, including BGP routing and DNS, to quickly identify problem areas and dramatically reduce your mean time to repair. You can pinpoint the root cause of device faults, congestion, Wi-Fi quality, DDoS attacks, and more. And you don't have to keep all this intelligence to yourself. You can easily share events, metrics, and dashboards with your vendors and customers so that you can collaborate to resolve problems faster. Now, ThousandEyes also aggregates anonymized real-time data from a collective data set so they can generate insights about large-scale issues across the internet, including their severity and breadth, as well as likely root cause. Now, if all that sounds good to you, here's a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. Try ThousandEyes for free at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. And while you're there, get yourself a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. That's thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. Manage every network like it's your own. ThousandEyes. Thrive in a connected world. And now, back to the podcast.
Really, we're talking about an ecosystem where if you've got the white box platform that you can load anything on, you've been liberated in that sense, and now you could put on a NAS or perhaps some specific daemons that do interesting things for you.
Yes.
The ecosystem is now opened up broadly. You're not just limited to whatever your integrated network operating system is that gives you X, Y, Z, and whatever features, BGP and OSPF and spanning tree, whatever the list is. Now it's, okay, anybody can go out there, write a process, write an operating system, and can program that data plane in whatever clever way, add a controller to the mix, and now you've got applications that could solve all sorts of interesting problems. Again, the playing field has been opened up there for anybody who's got an interesting idea and or unique business problem that is a void that needs filling. You've now got a business opportunity.
Exactly. And that code is in open, right? So if you need a change or a bug fix, there's a community out to help you.
Well, I mean, it wouldn't have to be open though, I guess, would it?
It can be closed, absolutely. But you know, if it is open, then it draws from the community, right? And those things move much faster because there's a lot more resources on it. So the customization angle, you're right. You know, that could be very specific to a carrier, and that could be closed, and that could be the secret sauce of vendors that supply to the carriers. Absolutely.
Mm. Another thought here is that networking, if you look at the IT stack as a whole, you've got compute and storage and so on that make up that IT stack. And networking has kind of been off to the side, whereas hyperconverged platforms tend to integrate all of the rest of the stack very well. Networking has been a frustrating element to integrate. It's been it's just been difficult. You know, Kubernetes is certainly making big strides here. There's a bunch of open source projects that are helping with this. So the question then is, does open networking, as we look down the road here, does it help make networking just an integrated part of the IT stack instead of this special silo that always seems to be the last thing, the last piece of the puzzle to get plugged in?
So my view of HCI or like hyperconverged systems, right, is it is great to use these integrated systems for specific workloads, right? And then you tailor your size to that. For most general purpose systems, right, if you can get the cost and efficiencies and the performance down to a point where they are, you know, going across multiple workloads, then, you know, most of it would not be, you know, hyperconverged, right? And so if you look at the market that way, our view is that open networking actually simplifies the way to do hyperconverged systems, because now anybody can integrate on the back end and bring the networking stack that is a lightweight stack for HCI, right? I mean, you don't need the you know, layer 4 through 7, and you don't need all the aspects of the routing stack to be in there. It's not a monolithic code anymore, right?
Right. You're making the point that you really need some layer 3 forwarding. You maybe need some multi-tenancy.
And some chaining here and there, and then just some quads, you know, across these servers that are making up the HCI stack, and then you're good.
Okay. So that's, we're going back to that Snowflake and simplification part of the conversation that we were having earlier. When you don't need much and you keep it simple, it becomes much easier to integrate. You don't have 5,000 little variables you're worried about and little nerd knobs that you need to turn if you keep your networking solution as simple as possible, which in that HCI application, as you said, it actually doesn't need much.
It doesn't need much, exactly. And by the way, that is an opportunity for customization for several startups and community players, right? You know, it's not, because again, remember, open source is not going to create products. It's going to create deployment-ready projects and components from which you know, members and end users can build products and solutions. And kind of that's the difference. And so every simplification step we take makes it easier to consume on the back end side.
All right. Now, we've mentioned simplification. Okay. Now, you've also talked about collaboration. And as we've looked at what the Linux Foundation has absorbed in the networking component, all the different projects, it doesn't actually seem simple just at the moment. It does seem like there's an awful lot going on. So I want to revisit this. Is there a risk here of adopting the wrong project because it's just not going to be viable, or it doesn't really have much of a future? That's a concern that any enterprise person has, wanting to bank on things. I forget how many projects that I'm sure you know off the top of your head, Arpit. There's an awful lot of them. Some of them seem similar in nature. Are we going to see some consolidation maybe of some of these projects, or does the stack as the Linux Foundation presents it, I mean, is it truly all Lego blocks that need to be there for whatever the individual reasons are?
Yeah. So again, the interesting thing to sort of note is that there are thousands and thousands of projects on GitHub. Okay. And I would say not everything is relevant. Absolutely not relevant, right? So I would say we focus on the 150 plus projects, right, which are really relevant in the market, and so from that perspective, if you double click those projects inside networking, we group them into the layers, as we all know, right? So there are, you know, many projects at the data plane layer. Now on paper it might look, oh, there are 5 projects, so things like DPDK, OVS, FDIO, OpenSwitch, et cetera. And then you look at it and go, oh my God, there's so many projects. But for the technical developers, you know, and for people who understand, you can sort of very quickly go and say, oh yeah, DPDK is a set of files that are being used by FDIO to accelerate the data plane. And that's kind of one package, right? And so you can see how they all come together. And then you say, okay, there are controllers on top of it that need to be integrated. So there's a layer of controller projects, right? So you've got Open Daylight, Tungsten Fabric, et cetera. And then you go, oh, I need brownfield, I need greenfield, I need overlay, I need underlay. And then those options dictate the solutions on the controller side. And then as you go up, we really, really want more harmonization. That's where ONAP has really, really changed the game. And it has become the de facto automation platform, because higher up the stack, you know, you don't want too many choices, because then it's an end-by-end problem to integrate into the OSS, BSS. Mm-hmm. So there we are simplifying with MEF and TM Forum and all the APIs, and making sure that by default, you know, you have a de facto standard that's just one, right? And but lower down, there are many choices that all fit together. So yes, it may seem like there are a lot of projects, but I can assure you that if we see projects that are like overlapping, Linux Foundation does not have a problem merging them. We did it with OpenO and Ecomp. There were two competing projects. We merged them and put it into one. And merge as in not bring them together in a governance structure, but actually integrate the code base, right?
Yeah, you're arguing that the projects that we see, even though there's 150 of them, they are necessary from some point of view or other. They may not be necessary for you, but as you look at your specific business situation and the Lego blocks you need to build an open solution for your environment, the pieces are there. You just have to pick and choose which are the right ones to cobble together the solution that
exactly.
you need.
Exactly. And they each of them solve a specific use case with a specific scenario in mind, right? And what I'm saying is, over the last couple of years, as we've seen, if we see duplication, if they're solving the same problem slightly better, we would bring the communities together and say, hey guys, you know, you're solving the same problem. It has been solved this way. Can we come together and come to a decision, right? But if for the projects you see, you know, they all have value because they are actually needed in a particular deployment or a use case scenario. And by the way, Linux Foundation does not own or host all of them, right? There are projects outside Linux Foundation also. And our job is to make sure that, you know, there is interoperability and partnership that we start forging. If there's projects outside that are important, but we are not necessarily hosting.
Well, for sure. But for a while there, it seemed like, oh, another press release from the Linux Foundation. They've absorbed another one. Look out, the monster's coming.
There was a time back there, Drew, when we used to talk about a new foundation every week. A lot of vendors wanted to have foundations and keep control of them. And then,
yeah, but right. But so I think what we have done since then, you're right, that was the case 3 years, 2 years ago. So if you know what we did this year is we integrated many, many of these projects, like the top seven projects, and put it under one umbrella called Linux Foundation Networking. So it simplifies the governance. It's a single governance. So still separate TSCs, which is the technical groups, but a single board, single governance. So it's and a single fee for that, right? So way, way lower dues, but more importantly, collaboration is happening between these projects.
No, I understand. I think most people understand that. My point was that vendors thought, no, we should set up our own foundation so we can keep control of it, which missed the point of being open, right?
Exactly.
When a vendor announces right. their API is open, it's like, duh, an API is open. It's by its very nature, it's open. Anybody can, you know, you can't close an API, really. All you can say is, I'm not going to tell you what it is, in which case it's not only closed, it's not even open, it's not even an API.
Exactly.
So much stupid that goes on,
Yeah, it's a redundant statement. It's saying proprietary is closed.
Yeah, but you can have a proprietary open API because I'm letting you use it and I'm going to publish the details, but it's not yours and you can't have it. You can't, you know, but my favorite one is the vendor that published an API, but then put a copyright statement on it and said, you're not allowed to use it.
Great.
That was hysterical. That was. I had some things to say about that at the time.
Well, gentlemen, I think this brings us to an interesting conclusion here as we consider the future of networking in the context of open and open networking and how disaggregation, white box, and so on is going to impact all of us in the years to come. Arpit, thank you very much for joining us. And if you would you share your social media handles? Where can people follow you, get in touch with you, and any other links that you'd like to send them to?
Sure. And really, you know, thank you for a very lively discussion. I would say the big links are obviously lfnetworking.org under Linux Foundation. The best way to reach me is obviously LinkedIn. But more importantly, you know, if you need to look at anything else, just do networking at Linux Foundation. You know, most everybody does Google searches these days, so that's what I would do. And then, of course, there are several reports that have been published. One is the standardization harmonization report that I would definitely encourage people to look at, as well as the open source job reports. That is very important. And there's an ACG paper that has been published on the business impacts of open source. So those are the tools. And obviously, there's plenty of YouTube videos as well. Thank you.
Great. Thank you again, Arpit. And if you're listening to the show and you're interested in some of those links or viewing that material, anything that we have a link to, if you look at your podcatcher application and look at the show notes that should be there, you can click right through on your phone to those or go to packetpushers.net. We'll also have the show notes there and you can click from there.
I would add one more thing. I'd like to see everybody at the Open Networking Summit Europe in Amsterdam in September. So take a look at that as well on our website.
Thanks again, and thank you for listening to Packet Pushers today. You can find this and many more of our fine, free technical podcasts, along with our community blog and news feeds at packetpushers.net. You can tweet at Packet Pushers, follow us on LinkedIn, rate us on Apple Podcasts, and become a premium member at ignition.packetpushers.net for even more content that we don't publish anywhere else. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.